I think we've met somewhere before. Hello, love. Hello, brotherly love. This is Garrison Keillor, hoping you'll join us Saturday evening at 6 for a Prairie Home Companion here on WHYY 91 FM in Philadelphia. Saturday evening at 6, we'll look for you then.
Also here, a repeat broadcast, Sunday morning at 10:30 on 91 FM.
Good afternoon. My name is Terry Gross, and this is a special edition of Fresh Air, the first of two programs which we will devote to a discussion of AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome. We're psychologically unprepared to face an epidemic that as yet has no cure, no vaccine for prevention, and is killing people in their prime. The average age of persons with AIDS is 36. Since 1981, when the condition was first identified in this country, 17,517 cases have been diagnosed in America, and 9,194 Americans have died. These are the latest statistics, as of Monday, from the Center for Disease Control. The American reaction to AIDS reveals much about how our society reacts to sickness, death, sex, and fear. Because the primary populations hit by AIDS so far have been gay and bisexual men and intravenous drug users, many Americans have detached themselves from the victim's suffering. Some Americans have even blamed the victims for their own illness. Gays for practicing, quote, sexual perversion, drug users for their illegal activities. The fact that the latest research shows that AIDS is spread only through direct contact with body fluids like blood and sperm has not prevented widespread hysteria about contagion through casual contact. Attempts to limit the population's exposure to the virus has resulted in exclusionary practices, mandatory blood tests, and other actions that call into question our commitment to basic civil liberties. At the same time, our society's discomfort about openly discussing sex has inhibited efforts to educate the public about how to have sex without spreading or catching AIDS. As the disease spreads, most of us are very worried. Some of us are grieving. Whether we have lost lovers, friends, or family, or fear we've already been exposed, or worry about possible future contagion, AIDS has become a frightening presence in our lives. On tomorrow's program, we'll discuss the legal, social, and ethical questions raised by AIDS, also the media coverage of AIDS, and the disease's impact on the gay community. Today, we'll discuss the medical aspects of the epidemic, how to prevent its spread, and the responsiveness of our social welfare system. In about 40 minutes, I'll speak with a doctor, an epidemiologist, and a social worker about the current medical knowledge of AIDS, its symptoms and prognosis, how AIDS is spread, and what are considered safe sex practices. We'll also hear from a buddy who works as a volunteer helping people with AIDS. First, we'll hear from a man who has AIDS. AIDS is a condition caused by the HTLV-3 virus, which attacks the immune system. When the immune system is suppressed by the virus, the person with AIDS is vulnerable to a wide range of rare infections which the healthy immune system would fend off, from cancers and pneumonia to parasites, viruses, and fungal infections. It's one of these opportunistic infections which is usually fatal to a person with AIDS. I spoke with a 32-year-old man from New Jersey who has AIDS. We will honor his request to protect his privacy by not giving his name on the air. He was diagnosed as having AIDS 1 year ago.
One day I was on the job, and all of a sudden, I just felt all my strength being taken from me. I couldn't even press the buttons on the computer. Everything just went, and I hollered for my supervisor right quick, and I told him that something was wrong with me, and I had to, you know, like, leave. And I went home, and when I got home, wasn't nobody there at the house or anything, so I just got into bed. So my sister happened to come in, and so she came in, and she saw that I was really sweating. Like, the whole bed was, like, really wet, like somebody had threw a bucket of water on me or something. Eventually, it came to where I did have to go to the hospital. And they found out that I did have AIDS.
How did the doctor tell you that you had AIDS?
Well, I really like my doctor because he's somewhat like a psychologist, too, I guess. You know, he gave it to me as easy as he could, you know. And of course, I was like, you know, I didn't know how to react or anything like that. You know, somebody telling you, well, you know, this is what's wrong with you. But as time went on, I was very depressed. I was depressed for months, you know. And now as I look back over it, I can see where being in the hospital, the time length of time that I was in there, which was 11 weeks, that everybody was wonderful to me because I was really delirious up in that hospital, you know. And
well, there have been some reports of medical staff being afraid to go into the room with someone who has AIDS or to touch them. You didn't find anything like that?
No, I never felt that anybody was, you know, afraid of me or didn't want to come in or anything like that. The nurses, in fact, there was times when they even hugged me, you know, and comforted me a lot of times, you know. I never felt that anybody was, you know, prejudiced in that way.
Did you know much about AIDS at the time that they told you you had it?
Nothing. I knew really nothing about it until, you know, after I, you know, got out of the hospital. I did go to the library and, you know, stuff like that, and I tried to get as many pamphlets and, you know, books on the matter, but before I got it, no, I didn't know anything about it.
What were you told to do so that you could protect yourself against catching germs from other people, since your immunity is repressed when you have AIDS?
Well, to be very clean, you know, clean behind yourself all the time, and if people were around me who had colds and stuff, to make them wear a mask, you know, and things like this here. But basically just to, you know, keep myself clean and, you know, I would be okay.
What about things like public transportation or, you know, going shopping and stuff? Is that exposing yourself to the flu or to cold? Can you do that?
Well, I would say, well, anything I would do, I would be exposing myself to. I'm exposed right now, you know. But, you know, I go shopping. Sometimes I do ride public transportation and all that.
Has your family been supportive of you? There also have been reports of, with some people who have AIDS, that their own family has been afraid to go near them. What has your experience been like?
My family has been great. Everybody supports me. You know, they've just been wonderful. You know, and I think that that's like the number one medicine, regardless of what medications you're on and all that, to have your family behind you 100%, you know, that's like the best medicine that one could have.
What about friends? Did you tell your friends? How do you decide which of your friends you're going to tell?
Well, you know, like I say, you never really have a lot of friends, and you know, and I don't. I know a lot of people, but far as like friends, you know, I have a handful, you know, and those are the ones that I choose to tell because I do be around them, and none of them have changed, you know. They, you know, they'll come get me and take me to lunch or, you know, just like we've always been. None of them have changed at all, you know.
When you got AIDS and you were in the hospital for 11 weeks, when you got out of the hospital, did you continue to work?
No, I didn't.
Was that a conscious choice? Did you decide not to work, or were you fired from the position because of your sickness?
No, I just decided not to go back my own self. Well, when I got out of the hospital, I was still in my depressed stage, you know, and I just didn't like me. I didn't want to do anything, you know. It was almost like I didn't even want to leave the house to do anything, you know, to be with anybody, you know. And that's why I say, you know, the family was some of the best medicine that I could have, and even my friends, because they were like, you're going out of this house, you know. They'd come and get me and, you know, come on, we're going out. You're not going to sit here like this. And I think all of that helped to pull me through the depression. And then I got sick again. in the beginning of August, and I spent 3 more weeks in the hospital. And by that time, things just start changing, my mind and everything. I started coming out of that depression.
What else helped you get out of the depression? Were you in any kind of counseling, or, you know, did any of your friends or family or your buddy say things to you that helped you get out of it? What happened? How did you get out of that depression, which lasted a long time and which you say you're not in any longer?
Well, you know, that's really a question that I'm really not sure exactly what did it. Well, only thing I know is that, okay, I've always been the type of person that I never liked to stay depressed for a long period of time, you know? And I did see a psychiatrist, but then it had gotten to a point where I felt like he had did all he could do for me. And so that's when I decided to join the task force at that point. After I stopped going to see him, I didn't want to, like, just stop everything, you know, because I wanted to do what was ever best for me. And, you know, like I said, after the second visit in the hospital, it just did something to me. You know, I just, after I came home, I started liking myself a bit, you know. I could look in the mirror and, you know, say to myself, yeah, I do like that guy. But, things just start changing, you know, and now I feel much better, you know, about myself and everything.
The task force that you joined was the AIDS task force?
Right.
Why did you join the AIDS task force?
Well, because at the time, like I said, I was seeing this psychiatrist, and seeing him did help, because when I first went to him, I really felt like I was incapable of making decisions, and I hated myself for that, you know. It just seemed like everything was just right on the top of my head, but I just couldn't make a decision about anything. It was like, I just don't care, you know. And it was always like I put it off on a family member or somebody, and I knew they would take care of it, you know. But it was like, you know, I just didn't care. And so after I went to him, I guess, for a couple months, and then I felt like he had did all he could do for me. So, like I said, I didn't want to stop there because I still felt that I needed something. And so I decided that maybe if I, you know, go to these meetings, because the doctor had even suggested, you know, me joining the task force. But at the time, I was like, you know, this is just not what I want, you know. That's not for me. But so I joined the task force and went a few times, and I got to like it, you know. There was that openness there, too, like you could just go and just spill your guts out, you know. And I felt real relaxed and all, you know, being there. And so, you know, that's what I did.
When you found out you had AIDS, did you ever go through a period of doing trips on yourself, of trying to figure out how you got it and why you got it and what that meant, and feeling guilty or feeling bad for having gotten it?
Mm-hmm. But, well, of course I did, you know. But then after a while, I was like, you know, I would drive myself crazy sitting here thinking, how in the world did I get this, you know, because it's like, I'll never know, you know. And so once I, like, really told myself that, I sort of, like, you know, cooled out trying to think like that. I mainly was geared to, you know, really trying to get myself together rather than depressing myself more, because I was already depressed enough without, you know, having to go through that.
Because a large group of the people who have AIDS are either gay or IV drug users. When people find out that you have AIDS, do they make certain assumptions about you? And, you know, does it get, like, more complicated than
well,
than you'd want it to be?
That's a good question, because, you know, that never comes up, you know. And in fact, I had said that I was going to ask my sister that question. Why was it that nobody ever brought that up to me or anything? But no, that question has never come up at all, even from my friends. You know, nobody ever asked any questions.
Are you glad, or do you wish that they would so you could talk about
it? Well, I like it like it is now, you know, but, you know, if somebody in my family was to ask, you know, of course I would, you know, tell them the truth. But, you know, like I said, I did think of that before, that that question never came up.
When you got sick, you left your job mm-hmm. because you were sick and depressed and didn't really feel like you could work anymore. Did you have any health insurance, or what did you do to support
no.
yourself when you were too sick to work?
Well, the only thing that I get right now is Social Security. But I didn't have any insurance or anything. In fact, when I had gotten this job, I had just started this job in December. This was a new job for me. And this happened like right at the beginning of March, like I said. So I hadn't really even worked long enough to even get the benefits and all that. So, you know, after being up there all that long time, and like I said, I was really depressed, so I just decided not to go back, you know. But I would like to go to work. In fact, I'm thinking about, you know, taking on a part-time job. I don't think I could work 8 hours a day, but I do think I could work for, you know, about 4 hours a day or something.
If you applied for a job, you'd have to confront the question of whether or not to tell the person who
right.
was interviewing you for the job that you had AIDS. Would you tell them?
I don't know. And in fact, that's another reason why it's really taken me so long, you know, to even decide on taking a job, you know, because I would want to tell them, because if I was to get sick there and a person knows what's wrong with you, you know, it would be better, you know. But, you know, that's one of the reasons why I still haven't gotten a job, because that does worry me, you know.
Well, it's a tough position to be in. You're in a difficult spot to get a job, because then the whole issue of
right.
you being sick comes up. And if you don't have a job, then there's no income
mm-hmm.
coming in. I think this is a situation that many of the people who have AIDS are up against. Are there any other support systems that you have financially to help you?
Well, no, not really. I mean, my family, they do all they can, you know, to help me out. And I live with one of my sisters and her husband, and, you know, like, the family, they are like, you know, they give her money sometimes and stuff like this here to, you know, help out with me. And, you know, and that's it, you know. And my financial status is really messed up. Yeah.
Do you ever end up overhearing conversations by people on a train or a bus or whatever about AIDS, and they don't know that you're listening and that you have AIDS? And what are some of the things that you've heard that have affected you?
Well, people seem to think that, you know, a person with AIDS, you know, they seem to think that their life is over, that they should just be excluded from everything, you know. And I have heard these conversations on the train and stuff like this here. But I just smile and go, you know, go on, because I know that these are people who have not educated themselves about AIDS itself, you know, because if they were trying to educate themselves about it, they wouldn't say some of the things that they would say. I mean, I just can't understand how you think that, you know, you can just exclude a person from life, because actually that's what you're doing, you know, and it just can't be done, you know. I'm still living, you know, and I have to deal with the world.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
The man who we just heard from has had AIDS for 1 year. We've honored his request to not mention his name on the radio. This is a special edition of Fresh Air about AIDS, and you're tuned to WHYY 91 FM. In a few minutes, I'll speak with a panel of medical experts about the AIDS epidemic and how to prevent contagion. Like the man we just heard from, many people with AIDS are unemployed because of their illness and have no health insurance. In their weak and vulnerable state, they have to learn to navigate the social service and medical bureaucracies. Because of unfounded fears of contagion through casual contact, the friends and family of some persons with AIDS are not always there to help. People with AIDS are sometimes treated like modern-day lepers. For these reasons, and because the needs of the person with AIDS are so overwhelming, a volunteer system was developed to help them. The volunteers, who call themselves buddies, assist with everything from house cleaning to filling out medical forms to serving as an advocate for the person with AIDS rights and for listening to their fears of dying. I spoke with Heshi Zinman, who for almost 2 years has been a buddy working with persons with AIDS, or PWAs as many people now call them. I asked him why he decided to become a buddy.
I volunteered to be a buddy basically because I wanted to give something back to the community. And also for selfish reasons, because I realized that I put myself in the situation of being a PWA, and I thought, you know,
PWA is person with AIDS,
you know, if I was diagnosed with AIDS, what would I need? Okay, I would need companionship. I would need a buddy. I would need assistance as far as finding out what is available, financial assistance, public assistance. So to give back to the community for all the positive things that I had gotten out of it, and just to help these people.
By the community, you mean the gay community?
Yes. Yeah.
Had you had friends who had AIDS?
I had two friends at that point, at the point that I volunteered, that had died from AIDS. And I have a couple of friends now that are dying from AIDS.
When you made a decision to be a buddy, seems to me it would be like making a decision to confront the reality of AIDS every day, as opposed to trying to forget about it or pretend it doesn't exist, or... was that a difficult decision to make? Because, you know, every time you visit someone who has AIDS, you're dealing with the reality of it.
You're dealing with the reality of it anyhow. You know, I am in a high-risk group, and living with the fear of AIDS is a day-to-day experience for me. So it was either sit back and worry about it, or sit back and worry about it and do something positive to help other people that were afflicted with AIDS. And that's what I decided to do.
What do you do when you're a buddy? What's the range of things that you do for a person with AIDS?
I think overall you try to improve the quality of life. You provide companionship. You provide... I do chores, okay, if somebody... right now I have a buddy and I do laundry every Wednesday. Wednesday is my laundry day. I actually allow his lover some free time to just do things for himself, okay, so that a lot of pressure is off his shoulders. And I guess, provide companionship. That's the most important thing that I do right now. But overall, you do anything that you have to make life easier.
Are you assigned a person to work with?
Well, PWAs, okay, have to contact... if you are diagnosed with AIDS, you have to contact the task force and ask for assistance, okay? Once that happens, it goes through, you know, there's sort of, it's channeled and it's given to team leaders, and then the team leader refers it to a person on their team.
Do you work with one person at a time?
Yeah. I think more than one person's a little too much.
How many people have you been a buddy to?
I've had four buddies. Right now I'm working with one. I've had... I have one that has Kaposi sarcoma that's fine. I mean, I don't think he's lost a day of work since he was diagnosed, which is usually the case with Kaposi's patients. But I guess actually I have two buddies right now, but one that I'm working with, I've had four altogether.
And have any of them died?
Two have.
My guest is Heshy's Inman, and he works as a buddy with people who have AIDS. How adequate has things like medical care, health insurance been for the people who you've worked with? And there is a real problem. Medical insurance is held mostly by people who are employed or who have a spouse that's got a full-time employment with good benefits. And if you don't have that kind of thing, or if you're a freelancer or you work part-time, you might not have health insurance. Has that been a problem?
Yeah, that's a problem, and it's my experience that most of the people that I've dealt with and that I know of that have had AIDS have gone the route of public assistance and medical assistance, and that is available. The thing that's frustrating about that is that there are waiting periods. Okay, for Social Security disability, there is a 5-month waiting period. I mean, you have to, let's say, for example, you have to be diagnosed and there's a 6-month waiting period. So for 6 months, you're sitting around and you don't have any money coming in. Medical assistance is almost immediate. I think, you know, time is the most important factor. If something takes a month for me, you know, to happen for me, that's fine. I have a month. For these people, a lot of times don't have the month to wait, and so it's real frustrating.
Your current buddy is, I think, on welfare.
Well, actually, the buddy I have right now had a very good job with a health facility in Philadelphia, and they have kept him on their insurance plan with full disability benefits and full medical insurance, which is just incredible. It really is. But I did have a buddy that was on public assistance, and it was probably the most frustrating experience that I've ever encountered as far as working through the red tape of the system.
What were some of those frustrations?
Well, unfortunately, he did not live to see any of his long-term disability benefits. The system had an address, had two different addresses on him, and they were sending his checks to one address, and here he was in the hospital dying. And by the time you filled out 30 forms to verify that this was not your address and that this was your true address and that, you know, you'd never receive these funds, and it took some time. It took a couple of weeks, and he didn't have a couple of weeks. So when he when he died, the government owed some $7,000 to him.
As a buddy, have you had to provide services for people with AIDS that you think the larger social system should be providing, but they haven't been because of discrimination?
Well, I think a lot of the legwork that I've done has been involved with getting PWA's information on public assistance, getting forms filled out for them. A lot of the work that social workers within the system itself should be handling and are not adequately. I don't really know what the case is, but I don't think that it's being handled the way it should be. It's my experience that if you walk into one of the, like a public assistance office and tell them you have AIDS, you will be rushed to the front of the line, not because they're sensitive to the fact that you have AIDS, but because they want you out of there quickly. They want you to fill out the forms and leave. I also personally have had, I had a buddy in a major health care facility in Philadelphia. He was in this hospital for, I'd say, close to 2 months, and on numerous occasions I tried to get the social worker, his caseworker, up to the hospital, up to his room to meet with him, and she always had one excuse after another for not going into his room. when I brought that to the attention of the task force and when we actually looked into it, her records indicate that she had several visits with him at his bedside in the hospital. I know that is not the case. I know that for a fact. So, yes, there are all kinds of inadequacies and discrimination that go on towards people with AIDS in the system.
Two of your buddies have died, and you've continued to have other buddies afterwards. Is it traumatic for you? Because I'm sure you get close to someone when you're their buddy.
It's the first time it happened, I was devastated, because I think that I had this sense that, you know, I'm going to fight and I'm going to not allow it to happen. I'm going to do everything I can to not allow this person to die. And there's nothing you can do, and it's frustrating. I don't want to say that I've hardened to it, because I haven't. I hurt all the time, not only for the people that I work with, but for anybody that is diagnosed with AIDS. I just do it because I know that it has to get done. That if, you know, if the laundry doesn't get done by me, I won't say that it won't get done, but chances are it won't get done when it has to get done. And so I just do what has to get done, and I think that that compensates for the sense of loss that you have at the end. You know, the fact that you just have to keep doing it so that the quality of life exists throughout the whole experience.
Is it difficult after you've lost someone to AIDS to start all over again and get a new buddy?
Well, it's been my experience that I sort of take some time off. The hard part for me is, you know, getting away from AIDS. This is something, you know, it's volunteer work. And I do as much as I can. And people have said, well, you know, you have to, like, get away. You have to spend a day, one day a week, away from AIDS. I agree, except that I have friends that are suffering. So I could walk away from the task force on Thursday and go into my own life, and now I have to deal with my friends that have AIDS. So it's something, I mean, for me, it's inescapable, and I would venture to say that for most people in the community that have had close experiences with people with AIDS, it's something that's a daily living experience and very hard to get away from.
Do you have friends, though, who are trying desperately to get away from it and who are doing, you know, obvious things that are just obviously, you know, denial or repression?
Well, no. I do not have, you know, my close circle of friends. We've all been through the ringer as far as AIDS goes, and you know, to deny it at this point would be ludicrous. But there are a lot of people that are still denying that it exists and that have not had personal experiences with people that have died from AIDS and really don't know how devastating it is.
You're in the process of organizing a group called Persons with AIDS, PWAs. What would be the functions of the group? Why do you want to actually organize people who have AIDS into some, you know, kind of coherent unit?
There are certain needs, specific needs, that should be addressed, okay, concerning AIDS. There are all kinds of emotional needs that are being taken care of. There are all kinds of support groups for lovers of people with AIDS, families of people with AIDS. There is the day-to-day living that only a person with AIDS can deal with. Again, so much of the fight is positive mental attitude. And when you wake up every day and you have nothing to do, okay, it's real hard to keep a positive outlook on life. And so some of the things that we hope to address will be organizing a comprehensive AIDS information library. Okay, we don't have one in Philadelphia. And so we are going to do that. And I would like to see it staffed and organized by people with AIDS. Okay, there is this image that the community has of PWAs as victims. Okay. And it is that image that I want to work away from, and I want to get these people to be participants in the whole process.
You know, I just want to stop you for a second. I noticed that you call people who have AIDS PWAs, which is an acronym for people with AIDS, and you're intentionally, I guess, not using the term AIDS victim, which is the term that's frequently used to describe someone who has AIDS. Is this a common thing you don't want to call AIDS an AIDS victim?
Well, we're all victims. We are all victims, and we're all open to getting AIDS. I mean, everyone. It's passing over into the mainstream of society. So we potentially can all be victims, but it's that I guess it's that whole image of let's feel sorry for these people. They're dying and you know, making them piranhas, and we've got to get away from that because these people have reasons to live, okay? They have to hold out hope because there is a lot of research that's happening. And so if they organize, okay, and they address issues of daily, you know, living, of representing PWAs in media, like in print, in the newspaper, on TV, organize a library, recreational outings, getting them involved in the training of buddies for support services. Okay, this is you're getting them to participate in the whole process, and you're sort of helping them to have a reason to wake up every day.
Has it been a politicizing experience for you to A, be involved in this kind of organizing, and to be looking at how people are reacting to AIDS and to people who have AIDS, you know, and
yeah.
has all that
politicized
you in a way?
Actually, I think that the social and psychological and political ramifications of this plague are, for me, the most frightening.
What are they?
Well, I am not that naive to think that quarantine camps can happen. My background, I grew up in a house where from the time I could understand what I was reading or comprehend what I was looking at, I heard all about the Holocaust and Germany and concentration camps. And I mean, this was part of my experience growing up in a Jewish household. And you know, I've given thought to these trucks pulling up outside my apartment house and knocking on my door and saying, you know, Mr. Zimmern, you know, you're gay. You tested positive for the HTLV-3 virus and come with us. You know, people might think that I'm taking it a little too far, but I think that it can happen. I think that this whole plague has been a cause célèbre for fundamentalist right-wingers in this country. And there are so many people out there casting stones at people with AIDS, at the gay community. I mean, it's one more reason, okay? It's one more reason, or it's more proof that we have a deviant lifestyle, and this is the price that we're paying, and that's, I don't buy it. But I think that the marketing appeal of this mentality is a real positive force, and that it could happen. And so it's issues like quarantine, identification cards that are real frightening to me.
Have you changed your life or your view of life being exposed to death and illness?
Yes. Life's very important, and I really have come to treat day-to-day living as if it's my last day, and I want to make the most of it. I've come to regard relationships with people as the most important part of my living experience. And I'm very fortunate that my close circle of friends have been very supportive of me. And there are times when I can call up any number of people and rant and rave and cry and scream, and they're right there patting me on the back. And I'm very fortunate to have the friends that I have. And I just think that my overall outlook of people and relationships and interacting with other people has really grown to be very important to me, much more so than ever before.
If anyone listening wanted to become a buddy, what should they do?
They should call the Philadelphia AIDS Task Force, Philadelphia Community Health Alternatives, and express their desire, you know, an interest in becoming a volunteer. There are different branches of the Philadelphia AIDS Task Force. I happen to be a volunteer buddy for support services. There is also fundraising, education, public relations, advocacy. So there's a lot of things that you could be doing for the task force if you wanted to volunteer.
Is anybody welcome? And I ask specifically because people might think that, you know, you have to be like part of the gay community.
No,
not at all. Anybody really work in this?
Anybody, please. You want to volunteer? Volunteer. We need volunteers. It's a massive responsibility. It's a massive task, and there before the grace of the task force goes nobody. And, you know, it's not a perfect volunteer organization, but it's the only organization, and I think we do a pretty good job at doing what we're doing.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
That was Heshy Zinman, who works as a buddy and is organizing a local chapter of Persons with AIDS. If you want to find out more about buddies or the new group PWAs, you can call the AIDS Task Force, and this is the number to call for any information from the AIDS Task Force. It's 732-AIDS, 732-AIDS. This is a special edition of Fresh Air devoted to the subject of AIDS. This epidemic will also be the subject of tomorrow's program. You're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, and this is Fresh Air. There's currently no cure for AIDS and no vaccine to protect against contagion. This has led to many realistic fears as well as irrational hysteria. During the remainder of the program, we'll try to dispel the irrational fears and discuss how to prevent exposure to the virus. With me now is a panel of medical and social welfare experts to discuss how the disease is transmitted, safe sex practices, and how to safely help persons with AIDS. We'll also discuss the response of the social welfare system to the epidemic, and we'll hear the latest statistics of how AIDS has spread in Philadelphia and what is forecast for the future. The best means we have now to limit the spread of AIDS is education on how to avoid exposure to the virus. Because AIDS can be spread through intimate contact, much of that information involves sexual practices. Since this is an urgent health matter and we all have very important questions, we're going to have a very candid, explicit discussion about what is now being called safe sex practices. If you would rather not be exposed to this discussion, you might try tuning us back in about 20 minutes. I have three guests. Dr. John Turner treats many patients with AIDS. He's an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and Temple University and is affiliated with Temple University and graduate hospitals. Dr. Robert Sherrar is an epidemiologist who's monitoring the spread of AIDS in Philadelphia. He's the director of the Division of Disease Control for the Philadelphia Department of Health. He's also an advisor on AIDS to the Mayor's Commission on Sexual Minorities. Roger Stevens is the chair of the Education Committee of the Philadelphia AIDS Task Force. He's the director of social work at Graduate Hospital. He's the president of the Society for Hospital Social Work Directors for Eastern Pennsylvania. I want to welcome you all to Fresh Air. And I should mention that, time permitting, we're going to open up the phones for your questions a little later on in the program. Dr. Turner, let me start by asking you to give us a layman's description of what AIDS is.
Surely. By now, practically everyone in the United States has heard about and read about AIDS, and most people are aware that the initials stand for Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndrome, and that includes two of the most important features that we need to know about AIDS. That is to say, it is not a single disease, but we use the term syndrome to describe a situation where there is a breakdown, in this case, in the immune system or the part of the body's normal physiology that we use to counteract microbiological organisms in our environment, like bacteria and viruses and other organisms. This is a very complicated, interrelated system in the body that is controlled very finely under normal circumstances and allows us to even get over the common cold and other things that medical practice really is fairly helpless to specifically fight. But in a person who has AIDS, this is not possible because part of the immune system has been attacked and, in fact, destroyed by virtue of the activity of a virus that we now call HTLV-3. I don't want to get overly technical, but that is the specific virus that has been found to be associated with AIDS throughout the world, as a matter of fact, although it goes by different names in different places depending upon who described it. That means that people who have AIDS are susceptible to a long list of unusual infections. These are infections that healthy people ordinarily never get in an entire lifetime. They are similar to infections that can occur in other people whose immune system is damaged, for example, because they have diseases like leukemia or certain other kinds of cancers, or because they have received medication such as immunosuppressive agents that would be given, for example, to a person who has a kidney transplant in order to promote non-rejection of that kidney transplant. They are very similar to the diseases that do occur in those kinds of people, so the diseases themselves are not new. The specific kinds of infections have been known often for a long time, and for some of them there are treatments available, although that's not always the case. But in a person who has AIDS, there is a susceptibility then to repeated episodes of these very serious kinds of infections. And because they tend to occur one after another and because the immune system is further destroyed, ultimately there comes a time when even the best treatment available may not be effective. I should further mention, by the way, that the immune system is not the only part of the body that is attacked by this particular virus. It also lives in and attacks neurological tissue in the brain, the spinal cord, and in peripheral nerves throughout the body. And there are a host of different kinds of often debilitating and, in fact, sometimes fatal neurological diseases that occur in patients with AIDS. And finally, there are some unusual kinds of tumors that occur in patients with AIDS as well.
Dr. Robert Sherrar, you're an epidemiologist, and you were just saying to me a few minutes ago, you were saying to me that AIDS is no longer a mystery. We know what causes it, and we know how it's spread. What we don't have is a vaccine or a cure, but it's not the mystery that it used to be. Now, when AIDS first became identified in America, there was a lot of hysteria about how it was going to be spread now. Now that we know more about AIDS, is there any way of spreading it through casual contact?
No, Terry, I would like to discuss briefly the modes of transmitting this disease because I think it's very important for the public to understand it. You're absolutely right. AIDS is no longer the medical mystery that it once was, and I think we should all realize that. It's true we can't treat it with a drug and we can't prevent it with a vaccine, but we certainly know how it's transmitted in the population. Now, we learn how a disease is transmitted within a population simply by looking at who gets the disease and who doesn't get the disease. Now, that's very important because that tells us how the disease is transmitted. Let me give you an example. When we look at who gets the disease, clearly about 73% of the cases have been gay men who've gotten the disease because of sexual activity. About 10% of the people have gotten the disease because of contact with contaminated blood. This would be through blood transfusions, factor VIII concentrate, or sharing IV needles. So that's the second mode of transmission. The third mode of transmission has been from the mother to the child during pregnancy or just at the time of birth. Now, who doesn't get the disease? You know, the medical profession has been providing care for these people for many, many years now, probably since the late 1970s, even before we knew we had a problem. And so far, no one in the medical field has developed AIDS because of occupational exposure. Secondly, we have studied a number of households and found that we're unable to document any spread of the virus within a household from one adult to another adult or from one child to another child through what we call casual, and by casual we mean non-sexual contact. And I think this is important. This is a disease that is not spread by casual contact. It is not spread by the airborne route, and there's absolutely no epidemiologic data to suggest that this disease can be transmitted by saliva or even by eating food that was prepared by an AIDS patient.
Okay, I'd like to discuss safe sex practices since one of the primary forms of transmission is through sex. Now, you just said, Dr. Sharar, that there's no real hard evidence of transmission through saliva. I think that's an opinion that's either still controversial or that's recently changed. Can you spread it through kissing? I really have heard mixed things about that, and I'd like all of your opinions since I thought this was something that the medical profession was still divided on. You're all nodding your heads.
Okay, Terry, let me just tell one story that takes place. There is a foster mother up in Newark that adopted twin children, twin daughters, and one of the little girls had received a blood transfusion at birth and had not been doing well. At 2.5 years of age, they discovered that that child had AIDS. The children are now between 5 and 6 years of age, and the mother not only took care of these kids, but was kind of the local daycare center mother and took care of a number of neighborhood kids. And when they discovered that the individual had AIDS, the CDC and other people went in to study the family. And they asked the mother, what was it like raising these children? And they said, well, they slept in the same bed, they played in the same crib, they shared the same toys. When I changed one diaper, I changed the other. When I fed one, I fed the other. In fact, the healthy baby, when she finished her bottle, frequently grabbed the bottle from the sick one and finished that one. You know, it's this very intimate, close contact that takes place within a household and particularly among children. And they studied these children. They analyzed their blood, and they had absolutely no transmission from that child to anyone else in the family. Now, that tells you a lot. If saliva were a mode of transmitting the disease, you would expect to find transmission in this setting. It has not happened.
Dr. John Turner, you agree saliva is not...
I absolutely agree. There is no evidence whatsoever that salivary transmission has ever taken place.
Roger Stevens?
How could I disagree with these experts?
Okay, let's talk about different forms of intercourse. And again, I want to remind our listeners that we are going to be talking explicitly about this. It's an urgent health matter, and we're going to be talking about it explicitly so that you have some understanding about what you can do sexually that won't transmit the disease or make you vulnerable to AIDS. From what we know, is anal intercourse more risky or more likely to spread AIDS than heterosexual vaginal intercourse?
That question is perhaps somewhat difficult to answer. Again, perhaps because in the United States, the majority of patients to date have been homosexual men, and we therefore tend to assume that anal intercourse is a more efficient, if you will, mode of transmission of the virus. Let me point out that the virus exists in cells called lymphocytes, and these cells are present in prostatic fluid, which is in the ejaculate, and that is the mode of transmission of the virus from one person to another. It can occur through either receptive anal intercourse or receptive vaginal intercourse. And as you're aware, in Africa and certain other parts of the world, there is a relatively even distribution of women and men who have AIDS. And whether or not that's because of receptive vaginal intercourse as a mode of transmission in those areas or because the health standards in those areas allow injection of medications into numerous people using the same needle, or which of those two is the case, is somewhat cloudy at this point. But I think we need to say that both vaginal and anal intercourse, be that homosexual or heterosexual, can transmit this virus, and that really forms the basis for the recommendations for the change in sexual practices that we're talking about.
Now, it's my understanding that the virus has to enter through the bloodstream. If you're engaged in a sexual practice, do you have to have a slight cut or tear in the skin through which the virus would enter?
It is assumed that during anal intercourse that there are minute abrasions to the walls of the lining of the rectum, for example, that allow entry of the virus directly into either the lymphatic system or the bloodstream system, and that the virus enters that way. Similarly, that can occur theoretically through vaginal intercourse as well. And furthermore, at a time near the menstrual period in a woman, for example, there are blood vessels that are exposed theoretically for a period of time to entry of microbiological agents that could be exchanged through vaginal intercourse.
Now, if you are having anal sex, Who is there a difference in the vulnerability of the person who's the active person and the receptive person in anal intercourse?
Statistically, there does appear to be a greater risk associated with being the receptive partner of anal intercourse. However, the risk is probably not zero for the active partner in anal intercourse or vaginal intercourse, for that matter. And that's why we would recommend, for example, the use of condoms as a means of blocking the transmission of the virus from one partner to the other in either direction.
Does that mean that that also that a man could get it from a woman who had AIDS through intercourse?
Theoretically, that is possible. There have been in the neighborhood of Dr. Shirarkin, correct me, but I think there have been maybe 50 or 60 reported cases of apparent heterosexual transmission from an infected woman to a man reported to the CDC. And although the precise mode of transmission, I think, needs to be worked out with some care, nonetheless, it probably can occur in that direction. Bob, would you agree with that?
Yes, I would, John.
Now, let me just stop and ask everybody if there's complete agreement with what's been said so far. Is there anything you'd want to challenge medically about the transmission of the disease of what we've heard so far? And there's plenty of questions left to follow. So
I would agree with John.
Okay.
I think the transfer of body fluids from one individual to another individual during sexual activity is what causes the disease to be transmitted from one person to the other. And I think it can occur with both rectal or vaginal intercourse.
Okay. Now we move on to the question of oral sex. Is oral sex as dangerous as far as giving or picking up the virus as intercourse is?
This is a very tough question. We've already, I think, dealt with the fact that we do not believe that salivary transmission is important. That is to say, you can't get it through kissing. Therefore, saliva would not transmit the virus through oral intercourse. Now, the virus be transmitted in the other direction? That is to say, could it be transmitted by swallowing semen? And the evidence to date suggests that, in fact, that is probably not a risk. Now, throughout the country, the various kinds of task forces, similar to the Philadelphia AIDS Task Force, the various kinds of health bureaus and agencies and so forth have uniformly proscribed, that is, have argued against swallowing semen in order to stay the epidemic. These recommendations all came from a time even dating even before we knew that there was a specific virus involved, nor anything about the biology of the virus. Everybody has been very reluctant to relax that proscription against oral sex, but I think to be scientifically fair, we would have to say that to date it appears that oral sex is a minimal risk, if it is a risk at all. There have now actually been some researchers who have flatly stated that transmission does not occur that way, the reason being that they believe the virus is digested by the hydrochloric acid in the stomach.
Yeah, I would just like to expand that a little bit. Part of the problem, one of the arguments to support the fact that oral sex might transmit the agent is that people do have, you know, bleeding gums, and that it's possible for the agent to enter through the buccal mucosa before it even reaches the gastrointestinal tract, where it probably will be digested by the gastric juices. I think the only thing to be truthfully said there is that we simply don't know if it can be transmitted that fashion. And some people don't believe it. Others think that it might happen. And in either case, I think it's a sort of thing, since we are dealing with such a serious disease, that the people, I think, should err on the side of being conservative there and not swallowing semen.
Roger Stevens, you are the head of the education part of the AIDS Task Force, and through that work with safe sex discussions. Now, I'm sure everyone would agree that you should wear a condom during intercourse, any form, heterosexual, homosexual, anal, vaginal intercourse, whatever. But we all know that not every condom, although they're pre-tested, not everyone is really perfect. What do you recommend? I mean, do you recommend really putting your faith in that a condom's going to work and offer you protection?
I think it's good to look at it in terms of reducing risk rather than absolute protection. And obviously, the only absolute protection is absolute abstinence. That's not a viable alternative for most of our people we're trying to talk to. So we have to present things in the levels, different levels of protection. Obviously, a condom is a better protection than not, and that's the way we have to present it.
How effective is a condom in that it covers the penis very well, but there are areas around the genital that also comes in contact with sexual body fluid? So are you really sure of being protected if, you know, a penis is sheathed with a condom?
I think if you block the transmission of the ejaculate from one person to another person, you have essentially blocked transmission. This disease is not transmitted by skin contact, so that the portion of the genitals that would not be covered would not really be transmitting the disease.
So everyone's in agreement that condoms are very wise to use. Is there, I don't mean brand here, but is there a certain kind of condom that you think offers better protection than another, or is it all the same? And I don't mean brand, but I mean material.
Well, I think the important thing is that people learn to use them properly, okay. And that means by putting them on early in the action and to make certain that they're not reused multiple times. I think to learn to use the condom properly is probably more important than which brand you use.
Is there enough pre-orgasmic semen to spread AIDS? In other words, should you put on a condom immediately upon making contact, making genital contact?
I'm not sure that we have the answer for that.
So you'd suggest erring on the side of caution?
Yes,
on that
I would.
One. Okay. Were you going to say something, Roger?
I think that erring on the side of caution is always the better way. And, take a very conservative approach to that question.
When you teach safe sex practices, what other things do you recommend people keep in mind, and what alternatives can you offer?
Well, also need to offer for gay men mutual masturbation and other types of activity, just simply hugging and kissing and so forth that are safe. And it's sometimes difficult to help people understand that can be satisfying. They have certain preconceived notions.
Okay. If you're just joining us, this is a special edition of Fresh Air. We're discussing the subject of AIDS. We're currently talking about safe sex practices, and I have a panel of medical and social welfare experts with me. Just speaking was Roger Stevens, who chairs the Education Committee of the Local AIDS Task Force, and he's the Director of Social Work at Graduate Hospital. Also with me, Dr. Robert Sherrar, an epidemiologist who's monitoring the spread of AIDS in Philadelphia. He directs the Division of Disease Control for the Philadelphia Department of Health. Also with me, Dr. John Turner, who treats many AIDS patients, and he's affiliated with Temple University Hospital and Graduate Hospital. We've been hearing a lot about promiscuity, how promiscuous people are more apt to get AIDS. At this point, given the amount of knowledge that we have now, which is a lot more than we had last year, is it the number of partners you have or what you do with those partners that makes you vulnerable to AIDS?
The number is probably not as significant as what you do. If you practice safe sex with each partner, then the number of partners is not the factor. It's the transmission of the ejaculate that is the carrier. And if that is the practice, then that's very, very clear.
Do we have agreement on that?
Well, I think, you know, the Public Health Service does recommend that the people limit their number of sexual contacts only because, you know, as we pointed out earlier, the condom is not 100% effective because it's not always properly used. And I think that, you know, one approach to safe sex is to be in a mutually monogamous relationship, and that does work for some people. So I think that my personal recommendation would be to limit the number of partners. But I think it is more important to use these safe sex techniques that were discussed earlier. You know, when the outbreak first began back in 1981, they did some studies that showed that the individual who was most likely to get AIDS was the individual that had the largest number of sexual partners. But now when you take a look at the data in terms of how widespread the virus or the infection is in the population, there is a cohort in San Francisco where 75% of the gay men who attend the VD clinic have been infected with the virus that causes AIDS. If you take that 75% and apply it to that select group, you realize that you only have to have contact with three other individuals, and you will have a greater than a 95% chance of being exposed to the virus. So, you know, you don't have to have large numbers of contacts anymore to become exposed to the agent. And that's why I think safe sex or the risk reduction techniques certainly become even more important.
I would like to underscore that, because there are couples I see, for example, who have gotten together within the last 6 months or last year and have now what they define as a monogamous relationship and feel that they can relax what it is that they do. And I have to tell them that in point of fact, they have to assume until proved otherwise that one or both might conceivably be infected with the virus, since there's a very long incubation period before symptoms might become obvious. And in fact, many people are capable of transmitting the virus without ever becoming sick. And so even in a newly formed monogamous relationship, safe sex practices must still be utilized. And I think that's really much more important than focusing on the numbers.
Well, that brings us to the question of the blood test, which will determine if you've been exposed to the AIDS virus. Explain a little more what the blood test is before I ask you the question.
Well, there's a blood test that is available that has been erroneously assumed to be a test for AIDS, which it definitely is not. The test was developed with great rapidity and great urgency because there was the obvious understanding that the blood supply of the United States was in danger of transmitting this virus to large numbers of people, particularly those who received large numbers of transfusions, cardiac surgery patients, hemophiliacs, other people with major bleeding problems who received more than just a unit or two. There was tremendous urgency, therefore, in trying to screen potentially infected blood and discard those units, and this particular test was the first one that has been developed and utilized commercially. It's an antibody test, which therefore detects the presence of a protein in the blood of the person who may have been exposed to the virus. It has a number of drawbacks in terms of clinical use from one person to another, however. It's good for screening blood. That's fine.